Support comes from the St. Louis Public Library Foundation. During these challenging times, free access to digital resources is a necessity. You can help our community stay connected. Support your St. Louis Public Library at slpl.org.
This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. Even for those who aren't aficionados of jazz music, the name Miles Davis is familiar and almost synonymous with the genre. The trumpeter and composer's most famous record, Kind of Blue, starts with a song that's become a jazz standard. So what? What might not be as broadly familiar is that Miles Davis was born in Alton and raised in East St. Louis. He began his musical journey right here in St. Louis, and this May marks the centennial of Davis's birthday, an occasion that's being commemorated with a series of events called Milestones that honor his work as an artistic innovator and cultural icon. Joining us to talk about those events is Peter Palermo, Executive Director of the Sheldon Concert Hall and Galleries. Peter, great to have you back on the show.
Thank you, Elaine.
And also with us is Gerald Early. Gerald is a WashU Professor of African and African American Studies and English. He also edited a collection of essays called Miles Davis and American Culture, Volume 1. It's great to have you back as well.
Good to be here.
So let's begin with the what it is, Milestones. Peter, tell us about this series.
Well, we're excited to present it. We're excited to have NEA support for the project as well, which is a whole other thing to talk about. But it's a sort of a grouping of four different activities that we're going to do, including a great concert on March 28th. Featuring a top band. John Beasley's the guy who put it together. He played with Miles as a keyboardist. And we will have a talk led by Kendrick Smith, who's a local jazz musician here in town, also from East St. Louis, a young man who can do a pre-concert talk for us about the impact of Miles on the jazz scene here in St. Louis in particular and on his life. Later in April, we will have a listening party, listening to Kind of Blue, which you just played a clip from, with two really fantastic local musicians, Peter Martin and Adam Manis. They have their own podcast that's, I believe, maybe the top jazz podcast in the country. It's called You'll Hear It. And the fact that they're doing it right here from St. Louis is terrific. And they're going to do a live listening party to Kind of Blue. And since they're both musicians, we'll have a piano on stage and they can talk about what they're hearing as compared to what the rest of us are hearing, which will be fascinating.
Peter, why is this happening at the Sheldon?
Well, we really wanted to, you know, hold up Miles and celebrate. I mean, what a titanic figure he is in jazz music and American culture. And the fact that he's from right here in St. Louis, we didn't feel like we could let the 100th anniversary go by uncommemorated. It should be celebrated all over the city, and I know other organizations are. This is our part of that.
Mm-hmm. Gerald, what is it like to know that this is happening right here?
It's very exciting. If Davis were alive, I hope he'd be excited too that his hometown remembered him because he had such a love-hate relationship with where he grew up.
Mm-hmm. So I'd like to get right into some of Miles Davis's music. Now, in the introduction, we played what might be regarded as Davis's most well-known song, So What? And that came from the 1959 album Kind of Blue, which, Gerald, you've noted, it's considered the best instrumental jazz album ever recorded.
Yes.
Now, what made it such a seminal work?
A couple of things. One is that the record swings but the record is at a moderate tempo. And so people can listen to it and not feel as though they're listening to very rushed kind of jazz music. People think of jazz as velocity. Here was a record that was very smooth and the tempos were moderate. The other thing is that the solos in the record are so well-structured. You can virtually sing Miles Davis's solo. It's so well-structured. And that made the music extremely accessible to people. So it's the record that the joke about the record is that here's a jazz record for people who don't like jazz. Mm-hmm. Because the record is so open and accessible, and it's so easy for people to follow, because people generally say, oh, I don't understand jazz, I can't follow it. But this record is just beautiful in that you can follow the music very easily.
Mm-hmm. Was your first introduction to Miles Davis much earlier? How did you come to his work?
I came to his work through that record. I was 12 years old, and my sister, my older sister, 14, and she bought this record and played it. And I said, oh, wow, that's a great record. I was not a jazz fan then, but I said, boy, this is a great record.
Uh-huh. How about you?
I had a similar experience. I was a young 20-year-old in Boston after growing up in Nebraska. There wasn't a lot of jazz in Nebraska. And I asked an older guy, he's like, well, I want to learn about jazz. What should I listen to? And he said, well, here, listen to this. Mm-hmm. And it was, I mean, everything that opened up for me my whole life after that from jazz came from that record.
Yeah. And for me too. And actually, in college, Quincy Troupe was one of my professors, and I didn't realize that he was actually a St. Louis native until, you know, many years later. So for many people, an introduction to Miles was kind of blue. Gerald, is there something in particular, though, that Miles was doing with this record that made it maybe ruffle feathers at the time? Like, was it considered to be enough of a departure that people didn't really know what to make of it?
It was a departure. The record is so accessible that people don't understand that it was experimental. Because it was his partnership with Bill Evans. His partnership with Bill Evans made this record possible. He wanted Bill Evans to play on the record because he liked Bill Evans' approach to music, and particularly because this music is based on scales rather than being based on chords. And so for Davis, that opened up the music, because Davis was very interested in the music having space and being open. And that's one of the things you get from listening to this record, is that it's very open. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people don't realize this record was an experiment because it sounds so accessible.
Yeah, right. Now, to get a sense of Miles Davis's range in the years that followed, I'd like to listen to just a little bit of a few different Davis songs in relatively quick succession. So we're going to start with Paraphernalia, and this is from his 1968 album, Miles in the Sky. Now, just a year later, in 1969, Miles Davis recorded a two-song album called In a Silent Way, and one of those songs was Shh, Peaceful. And then in 1970, Davis put out the Bitches Brew album, which included the song Spanish Key. Mm-hmm. those three pieces, and then what we heard with So What? I mean, I realize this is a very big question, big enough maybe for a monograph at least, or, you know, a whole other volume of essays. But how does what we heard, you know, across those clips of Davis's work, Gerald, exemplify a capacity or even a drive to innovate?
Davis was always interested in wanting to get a new sound. He was what he had done in the past never interested him. So he was, for instance, with Kind of Blue, he never did a record like that again. He did it and he said, okay, fine, I've done that, and he went on. In Paraphernalia, what's interesting is that he decided his regular quintet, he would add a guitar. So George Benson is playing on that, and he said in an interview why he did that, and he said, well, I just heard a guitar when I was configuring the music, and so I added a guitar. And so he was interested in wanting to do something different in that regard, in the configuration of the music, and not ever going back to doing something else. Ship Peaceful is a very interesting record because the solo in the record is the melody of the tune. And that's really quite incredible that the solo is the melody, but it is. This was the time when Davis really began to experiment with a rock sound. He was very interested in that. There were practical reasons for that because jazz venues were closing. The audience for jazz was diminishing. He felt he needed to reach younger people, so he needed a sound that would be attractive to them. And so having a sound that was more of a rock sound, he thought would be more attractive to them. But he was also just more interested in wanting to do that because he said, this is the music of now. I'm not interested in playing what I used to play. This is the music of now. And so it was with when he did Bitches Brew. Interestingly enough, the title for that record came from the woman who became his wife, Betty Mabry, who became Betty Davis, who was in fact a performer herself. She was the one who told him to call it that.
As you're hearing Peter Gerald describe Miles Davis, I mean, what are you thinking? What are you feeling?
I'm listening to those clips. What was astounding to me is that it's Miles. It's unmistakably Miles playing trumpet. You can't, even from a generalist like me, who's not an expert, I can tell that that is Miles playing that trumpet. There's just something, you know, particular about his style. And like I said, this is, he's a titanic figure that encompasses so much of jazz history, from bebop to, you know, Bitches Brew and into the 80s. When he really got electric, he's just really spans the whole century of the 20th century.
Gerald, in what ways did that constant evolution, looking at what was new, what was fresh, make an impact culturally?
Well, I think it made an impact in, first of all, in the field of jazz, because he became a kind of Pied Piper for younger musicians. He was the guy people wanted to play with because, oh, he's going to give me this kind of freedom to do stuff. He's not an old fogey. He doesn't want to go back and do these old records. He doesn't want to do Body and Soul for the 150th time or something like that. So they found his adventurous nature to answer something with what they were looking for in jazz. I also think on the whole that Davis wound up making jazz seem adventurous to the general public in a different way than what some other jazz musicians were doing. Because despite sometimes the dense sound of everything that he was doing, there was something that was hip about what he was doing. And I think that made it very attractive to, especially younger listeners, it made it attractive to them.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I instantly feel cooler listening to the music, but cooler like in different ways with the different pieces.
He was always cool. Wasn't
yeah.
He?
I mean,
yeah. One of the things we have on display at the Sheldon is a jacket that he wore on stage to perform in Paris in the 80s. It's pink polka dots with white and purple, and it's crazy, but he could pull it off.
Right, right. So One of the other pieces that you had mentioned, Gerald, in our back and forth to prepare for this conversation had to do with a song called Write Off. Mm-hmm. And it comes from a Jack Johnson documentary, a famous pugilist, right? The message of that film, that documentary, and then Miles Davis is composing and playing for its soundtrack. What did that also say about how Miles understood himself in the context of American culture and what he felt people needed to hear?
Well, I think, number one, he was attracted to do this soundtrack for the Jack Johnson documentary because he kind of identified with Johnson in some way. He saw himself as a rebel. He saw himself as a man who had been, in some ways, not as appreciated as he could have been because he was a black man. And so he had this strong identification that way. Plus, Miles Davis as an avocation boxed. He liked boxing. He liked being physical. He was very proud for a long time of his physique, of being fit. And so that's another reason why he was attracted to doing this particular music. And so I think that on the whole, that it showed, this record showed exactly how well you can marry rock music with jazz. I think it fulfilled it better than any of his other records.
Mm-hmm. Does that have any connections to St. Louis specifically, Gerald?
I can't answer that. I'm not really sure if it really does. I think that he had this love-hate relationship with St. Louis, but St. Louis was also where he felt he got his sound. He said there was a certain kind of sound that jazz trumpeters from St. Louis had, and he said he always had that sound. So in that respect, the sound that he got on his trumpet, yes, I suppose it could be saying something about St. Louis. Mm-hmm. He always felt he left St. Louis in a way that he wasn't very happy, but he always felt connected to St. Louis. And one of the reasons that he got Quincy Troupe to help him do his autobiography was because Quincy Troupe was from here. Mm-hmm. And that was important to him.
He wanted someone from here to represent him.
Yes.
Yeah. So this, you know, I've mentioned that Milestones is part of centennial celebrations that are happening actually all across the world. It's happening here in St. Louis and at the Sheldon, where there were major renovations that were completed last year, reopened in October. Is there something particularly meaningful about having received an NEA grant when so many were not available that supports this Miles Davis series, Peter, in the new Sheldon, and also about being able to present these events about such an iconic musical and cultural figure at this moment?
Well, I think that the Sheldon, at 112 years of its life now, is maybe from the same era a little bit as Miles was. And the fact that we have given it rebirth with these renovations that we've done and really trying to set it up to live for another 50, 100 years, just as I think that we're still talking about Miles and his music, you know, long after his passing, centennial celebration. I think that it's fitting that it's at the Sheldon, which has always been a community-based organization built by citizens, kept up by citizens. And I think that it's important for the Sheldon to be a reflection back to St. Louis of the best things about St. Louis.
The first event in the Milestone series, it happens on March 28th. It is, again, called Unlimited Miles. Yeah. What can people expect or anticipate, Peter?
It's going to be a great band led by John Beasley, who's a keyboard player, as I mentioned, who played with Miles, and includes Sean Jones on trumpet, who's a magnificent trumpet player, was part of Wynton Marsalis's Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra. Mark Turner, Kurt Rosenwinkel, Ben Williams, and Tarion Gully. Tarion also from East St. Louis. So Tarion Gully on drums. He's a fantastic player. He's been at the Sheldon a number of times. So I'm excited to see him. That'll be a great concert. And they're really exploring the whole breadth of Miles's catalog, breathing new life into it, not trying to recreate, but really celebrating and opening it up to new, you know, just like Miles would have. Mm-hmm. Let's open it up to some new players and see what happens.
Peter Palermo is executive director of the Sheldon Concert Hall and Galleries. Gerald Early is a WashU professor of African American Studies and English and the editor of Miles Davis and American Culture, Volume 1. Gerald and Peter, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Unlimited Miles, Miles Davis at 100, is the first in the Sheldon's events celebrating Miles Davis. It takes place in the evening, March 28th, Saturday, 8 p.m. For more information, visit thesheldon.org/events.
This episode was produced by Elaine Cha.
Our audio engineer is Aaron Doerr. This podcast was mixed and edited by Aaron.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.